website.
Yeah.
Kind of redoing that. She loves doing stuff like that, so.
Oh, there it is.
Well, this other deal, I mean, a bookkeeper. Sounds like she'd be great at it, but it's gonna
be a fair
amount of work.
Sure. That doesn't scare her.
How would she get it all done? Just stay up late?
That's what she like. Check like that. Like she's usually goes to bed at 9 o'clock kind of person, but the last week or so we're not supposed to 10:30, 11.
All right.
But this would be all year. I mean, this isn't just like one and done. You're doing it consistently.
Okay. We're live.
We're live. We're ready to go. Okay.
We'll talk.
Good afternoon. This is a work session. I'm Commissioner Brian Crashes, joined by Commissioners Randy Christman and Julie Fedorchak. Again, this is a work session related to the Aurora Wind Project, case number PU-18-351. For the record, let's start with you, Jerry, and then we can just move around. If you could identify yourself for the record, then I believe we also have one person on the phone bridge.
Sir, Jerry Land with Commission Staff.
Zach Pelham, Commission Attorney.
Victor Shook, Commission Staff.
And do we have someone on the line?
Yes, this is Molly Smith on behalf of Aurora.
Okay, thank you. With that, Commissioner Fedorchak, you are the portfolio holder. I will turn it over to you.
We are good. Thank you, Brian. So this was a fairly straightforward hearing, but there were a couple late filed exhibits of that sort of thing. So I think I'll just turn over to Zach and he can go through that information and we can work through any other outstanding issues.
Thank you, Commissioner. There was actually only one late filed exhibit. Well, actually, I take that back. Two late filed exhibits. One late filed exhibit, the company exhibit 32, and then exhibit 33 was David Hessler's memo related to the noise study, and that has been both documents have been docketed. So there were not really many outstanding issues on this particular one. I think the one area that is still not completely determined, but appears to be well on its way to being signed are the two remaining landowners who are going to be participating in the project. They have yet to sign the lease agreements with the company, but as of an email from earlier today, those landowners are on the verge of signing those leases, is what I understand. Apparently, the attorney for the landowners had some additional comments on the lease agreements, and Aurora Wind approved those changes, and now Aurora is just waiting for confirmation that those revisions are addressing all of the issues from the landowner's attorney. Those have not been signed yet, but it appears that they will be in short order. The other issue that was left a little bit cloudy in the hearing was the voluntary, the potential for voluntary offsets for mitigation, and that would be done potentially. It was discussed at least as a potential at the hearing as to funding for one of the, I can't think of the name off the top of my head, Jerry, but it was an environmental group in North Dakota to provide some funding to that entity. And this morning I learned that there is a funding proposal that's been internally approved by Aurora, and they're working with West to prepare the written proposal to submit to Game and Fish. So that is in the works. As far as the architectural mitigation, you may recall that SHPO wanted a kind of report or article done on some of the features that were identified in the architectural review to be done, and it's my understanding that SHPO has approved the plan of the company that the company submitted. So those are, I believe, the I hesitate to kind of call them outstanding issues, but the remaining matters that were left a little bit unbound at the hearing. Jerry, I don't know if I may have missed something or if you have any other comments.
I think you did a pretty good job.
Okay.
There was quite a lot of testimony in favor of the project by the public. But there were those Larsons.
Yeah.
Or was it? I can't remember.
Yep.
If they both were last name Larson, but Teresa Larson
brother and
her
sister.
Brother Bill, and they were kind of in that one corner, and I can't remember if there was any ongoing discussion between them and the company that was referenced in the hearing.
I think, as I recall, Commissioner, both indicated that they, one, weren't opposed to the project, but they had a little bit of, call it a beef with maybe some of the communication, and from their perspective, a lack of communication and being advised as to where this project was going to be placed. Of course, that's what they testified to. I think that the brother, his name escapes me, it's in my notes
Bill.
Here, Bill, it indicated that the company did offer some form of compensation, but he didn't view it as significant.
Right,
from his perspective.
That would preclude him from participating in any future additional wind project if he signed up with them for that.
So yeah, I think that I don't recall specifically if that was one of the reasons, but I know that as I recall, Commissioner, I think it may have been more a discussion on just the proximity of where he's at and if there was a future wind project unrelated to this one, whether or not he would be precluded potentially from being participant in that project just because of the proximity mm-hmm. of his property to there. I guess I don't recall specifically that point, but that which isn't to say that you're not right either.
Okay. Let's see. The Game and Fish doesn't really spell out the exact impacts and stated a majority of the project is within a relatively low sensitive area with respect to native habitats. And so it seems like the issues that they've raised, especially considering that the company has ongoing discussions with them about some mitigation, it doesn't seem like there's any outstanding issues. From the environmental standpoint with habitat.
I would agree with what you just said, Commissioner.
And the sound issues were analyzed and addressed?
Yes. And just so I have Gregory Larson as the brother-in-law, not Bill.
Oh, okay.
In my notes, but I don't know that really matters too much.
Do we have any issues that we want to discuss regarding that journal article, the journal length article that SHPO's requiring or suggesting? Well, I don't know. Is it a requirement?
Well, I will say this. Oh, was that a question? Maybe that was a question for
no,
Zach.
No, I think it was for you guys.
Okay. Well, I had the same. I wanted to know exactly, is that normal that they would do this, or does this in effect become?
I think SHPO is branching off a little bit into this architectural stuff in the last few cases, and this seems to be a product of their efforts. They found significant impact on the architectural study and said for mitigation that they would accept a journal article.
Right.
And they said that they expected that article to take some time to do, and that they didn't think the project needed to be held up to get this article done in a year or two for the article.
They being the company
SHPO.
Or SHPO itself.
What I can do with that, Commissioner, too, is an email indicated earlier today that there's apparently some type of concurrence from SHPO. I'll see what I can do to get the company to have SHPO submit a letter just indicating what specifically what has been agreed to. But as I understand it, SHPO did have it in their determination, and the company did not object to it. So I don't believe it's an issue. If everyone's in agreement from the company and SHPO's perspective, I understand it, though, from your perspective as to how that may play out in future cases. And I'm kind of a believer in, look, every case is distinct, and each case has its own circumstances. I wouldn't view this as a precedential setting type of situation. I would view this as in this case, SHPO made these recommendations. The company didn't dispute it and agreed to do it, and we accepted that. And in the future, if SHPO says something and the company says, well, we don't think that they're right, then this decision here isn't going to bind you on that future case.
That's a good point, but I will say this. You know, we have two state agencies, but if you count U.S. Fish and Wildlife, I guess several different agencies that have brought up issues of concern and seeking either that this shouldn't happen or that things be changed so that those concerns aren't realized or that something is done to mitigate them. I think U.S. Fish and Wildlife stuff was pretty much a carbon copy, but I'm thinking more directly of Game and Fish. And they bring up issues, and they cited studies and said that the company agreed that some of these impacts were real, and the company didn't dispute that. To me, that's different than just saying, oh, you know, we think there's some things here, and so we'd like you to do something. I am okay, I guess, with this. I don't have real strong feelings about it. But based on what I thought was a very weak case by SHPO that of the impacts, unless I've just forgotten and their points have been dulled, but I just don't recall it as a strong case for anything. I'm okay with not even addressing it because I didn't hear a lot there.
I think it should be addressed just because it's in the record and it should be mentioned in the order just because it's out there. Not that it's more or less closing, tying off a knot is the way I see it. I don't see it popping up in this case as being an issue. But I think from a practical and a procedural standpoint for the commission, I think that it should always, you know, the best practice would be to address something that's been brought up at the hearing. Because you never know which case is going to be the one that's potentially appealed from. This one sure doesn't appear that it would be. But I think we have to go in operating on the assumption that every case is potentially going to be appealed from. And we have to come in with that mindset. Because on the one case where we don't, that's going to be the one that's an appeal. And then we're going to have a record that may not be as strong as it could have been or maybe should have been.
I had planned to put it in the order just that they required the Class 2 study, and I think we put it in the Emmons-Logan order too.
They required a Class 2 study.
Yeah, which is the architectural study.
Well, here it's being called the Class.
It's a little bit different in this one than Emmons-Logan. And this one they're requiring
Historic Age Resource Reconnaissance Survey.
Yeah.
And Class 3 Cultural Resources Inventory.
Yeah. But in this one they're requiring an actual article to be written, whereas in Emmons-Logan it is not.
Well, I guess I don't oppose having it addressed in the order because I do think that's, you know, true. It's in the record. What I'm more curious about is, I mean, we typically get the notice about the, you know, no significant sites affected determination for the archaeological piece. I don't recall, maybe we haven't, I haven't noticed it before, or I've just missed it, but I don't recall getting this historic age resource reconnaissance business before, and so I guess what I'm want to know more is from SHPO, like, what is this? Is it new? Why are we seeing it? How should we, you know, like, tell us more about this?
Yeah,
and that's where I just feel I didn't make it.
Well, it is in here. I mean, there's quite a lot of information in terms of the Burns McDonald, you know, the actual consultants who went out and did the study. But I guess, and maybe it is outside of this case, but just reaching out to SHPO to better understand what is this and why are we doing this now, or why are you doing this now? And, you know, it's just a new thing.
Yeah, I can ask them to give us something on it. My understanding is that it is a visionary type thing. The view shed, what are you doing? If there are resources around there, how does it affect them to have a
visual
wind farm in there?
Yeah.
In their view shed?
We did have it one other time in Foxtail, I think. There was some view shed stuff in that.
I think we've done it before. I remember some case where there was some talk about how it affected the river, the view shed from the river. And so I think it's been done before.
But well, remember the Native American, the important Native American site out there in Foxtail? Quite sure it was Foxtail.
Yeah,
and they did, they came and showed the, I mean, we actually got pictures of what the view was going to look like with the wind farm out there.
Yeah.
They were, you know, computer generated. So I'm just more interested in it seems like we should be applying this on every project, or it should be similarly applied consistently, but maybe we just leave that up to SHPO.
The interesting thing is in similar vein, all of the other agency comments that come in, I mean, in some respects, SHPO's a little bit different than other agencies, but because they provide a recommendation and the company, they'll concur, a concurrence letter, so to speak, right? But, it's similar in vein in some respects to the Air Force saying, well, okay, you can place this feature, you can place this, you know, near our easement on a nuclear missile ICBM site, similar to, the health department or the geological survey saying, well, this feature here. So, I mean, I think it's different in the sense that the recommendation here is to do the report. That's the piece that is a little bit different, I think. And it's new.
The latest recommendation. I guess what concerns me is the things they're listing.
Mm.
Barns.
Yeah.
A couple churches.
Right.
A bridge. I mean, so it might not be precedent setting, but those things exist everywhere in North Dakota. Run room schoolhouses.
And it would seem then on every future case, and then is this going to be the
right,
the standard operating procedure
and
from SHPO?
And an article is one thing, but
yeah.
What else are they going to be requiring?
I see your point.
For mitigation, I guess.
Are these registered buildings, or are these just buildings that it says historic age?
I don't
resource
know.
Resource reconnaissance survey they reviewed.
I don't recall, Commissioner, if these were on the historical National Registry or anything like that specifically. Maybe some of the churches would be. I don't know if whether or not they're eligible or not is another question.
So basically, if it's an old building, now it's tied to a visual impact.
Well, right, and I mean it's one of those intra-agency areas that I think it makes a lot of sense for Jerry to give them a call and to see what's going on as to this. Is this going to be what's going to be called for in the future? Because we all understand why, you know, there needs to be an area, you know, avoiding for ICBMs or landslide areas or geological unstable areas and other impacts. Those aren't necessarily changing those criteria. Here, the criteria seems to have changed a little bit on this one. And where is that being directed to? And then in our rules, how does that impact how the company sees this as well? Because the company, if you're the company, you're going to be thinking, well, if SHPO says to do this, well, the commission's going to say, well, if you don't do what SHPO says, then the commission's not going to give us the permit, so they're going to want to do what SHPO says. So, which isn't to say that, you know, we're in any respect beholden to what the company's concerns are, but in a big bowl of a fair playing field, it ought to be known amongst all participating in our hearings what's expected and what isn't.
Okay. So here's what the Burns and McDonald, their archaeologist consultant, says of the accessible resources from this Historic Age Resource Reconnaissance Survey. The 13 properties contain resources that appear to meet NRHP, National Register Historic Places eligibility criteria. The remaining lack historical associations or architectural integrity are not recommended. None of the NRHP listed or eligible resources would be directly or otherwise adversely affected by the project, thus no further consideration of historic age non-archaeological resources recommended. So their study says there's basically, if I'm reading it, there's nothing there, but then SHPO came back and said there's these two barns, another two barns, another
is that
barn.
Included in the 13 that is listed in Burns McDonald, or is that's not?
Yeah, clear? I don't know. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 11, it looks like here.
Okay.
I don't understand how they got to this requirement of the article.
Sure.
I don't understand what the article is even supposed to be about.
Yeah.
To mitigate this, so it just seems weird.
So I'm assuming that, I better rephrase this, is not to come across as sarcastic.
You don't have to. I can take it, Commissioner, whatever you got.
not for you.
I know. That's fine.
These are inanimate objects.
Yeah.
So the visual impact would, I'm assuming, be if someone were to go look at one of these very old buildings and feel that their experience was no longer as enriching?
Maybe.
I suppose. I mean, in this, I don't know that this is even necessarily a legal question either. It seems to be more of a policy-driven decision by SHPO to take this approach. And what's changed, I can't answer that question. From the perspective of this application, this siting hearing, this record, I think everything is from a legal perspective satisfied. But I understand what you're saying from a policy's perspective. What you, as a commissioner, are concerned about, you need to get a handle on what SHPO is doing, because you can't just consider this one case alone, because there are going to be many other cases.
Yeah.
I just think when we have these hearings, and there's both filings and the information we get at the day of the hearing, and to me they're both important. And whether it's an agency or an individual, every single thing that someone throws out there, we can't address, nor can the company be expected to mitigate them just because someone threw something out. It's, to me, we do address these things when they have made a good point that either the company countered it with something else,
sure,
to show that they were wrong even though they had originally made a good point, or what the company is going to do to offset it. One of the two.
Yep.
In my opinion, if this is important to SHPO in the future, for me to have to make a better case or explain it better, I just was left lacking here.
Yeah,
because they call it a significant sites affected. So I guess if it were to boil down, why are they now considering this barn, church, barn, church, bridge, granary, significant sites?
All of a sudden, right.
And how does a journal-length article on historic architecture in Williams County mitigate the visual impact to these sites?
Well, maybe we gave them a good idea when we had the settlement for the Dakota Access and we had all of those unique ideas on resolving things, maybe. And they thought, maybe we could do something else to better the good of the folks in this community to have a report on their barns and churches. And now I'm being a little bit sarcastic, and I apologize. But I don't know the answer.
Well, I'm not opposed to the article. I'm not. I just wanted to say I'm better understand it and where this is going down the road. And they do state in their letter the mitigation project itself does not need to be completed for okay for this project.
Right. Right.
I will add, and I don't know what legal weight this has. I expect I'll find out in a moment. But it's on the record. The company agreed to do what they wanted anyway with writing this article. I just don't know that we need to address that because I just didn't find anything meaty on it.
But ordinarily, Commissioner, I think we would address what SHPO has recommended and what SHPO has said. I mean, ordinarily we would include, you know, this is what SHPO did on this cultural feature, this cultural resource.
I would have a finding on it, but nothing else.
I mean, we don't have to, I don't think that it would be in the order. I agree with Jerry. It would just be a finding. This is what happened. I mean, it would be 2-3 sentences, I would think.
Yeah, minimal.
And the other thing, too, and I mean, not to kind of beat a dead horse on repeating here, but the company could have presented evidence, objected to the finding of SHPO, and we could have considered it.
Yeah.
The company said, fine, we'll do it. It's not an issue. So I think this case, that's what potentially differentiates a future one. In the future, nothing stops a company from saying, look, this is unreasonable. SHPO is requiring this. We don't agree with them. And then you all can make a decision.
Yeah. Yep, agreed. But meanwhile, and maybe, I don't know if there's a way to tie it to this one or if we just want to just get, but let's find out what SHPO's doing.
Yeah, I'll just call Susan over there and ask her what's going on.
Yeah. I don't recall the same thing in her most recent hearing, so it's, maybe there's no barns and houses up there. All right. So there's that. I think that was probably the one thing that popped out that I found the most curious about this particular hearing. Is there anything, do you guys have any other
issues? I have a few things.
Okay, why don't you go through yours, Randy?
Okay, one of them I wanted to bring up, and I'm not asking for anything changing the order, but I just don't want this discussion to have not acknowledged it because I expect it could continue to pop up and it's an evolving issue. And that is these IRIS, if I'm pronouncing how they usually pronounce the acronym correctly, interconnections have caused a lot of problems in other areas of SPP. And I don't want this to be precedential in that, well, you know, you've allowed them before, so you can't deny the next one and the next one and the next one. No one testified against this, and we have two transmission members of SPP that could have, and they chose not to. But it's a big ongoing discussion topic at SPP, and it's caused huge problems for particularly one company, but I think several. And I'm fine with not really addressing it here, but I did want to have it brought up in the discussion as this continues to evolve and more discussions at SPP take place. It may become more of an issue on future projects.
Can you say the type of?
It's ERIS, and I will let Victor explain it, and we'll have more chance of having it explained completely correctly the first time through.
And this one was which type of a connection?
This is IRIS, and the other one is NRIS.
And the better
NRIS, real generally, NRIS connections, that company has a more firm access, but if it causes down the road upgrade problems, they have to pay for that. The IRIS kind of gets on, and they're hit and miss, but they do take up transmission capacity, and a little down the line, another one and another one come on, and all of a sudden you need to upgrade lines, they don't have to pay.
So what is ERIS?
So Energy Resource Interconnection Service is ERES. Network Resource Interconnection Service is NRES.
Are they companies? Are they technologies?
No, it's just different types of service that you can get from SPP.
Okay.
ERES is much more kind of like it sounds like. It's on an energy-only basis as the system can take it, is kind of the idea. Both of them, you have to pay upgrade costs. However, with ERES, your chances of having an upgrade necessary at that time is much lower.
So it's a cheaper way to connect.
It is a much cheaper way to connect. Generally, the study is with system intact. They kind of turn stuff down to accommodate the new generator, and they, yep, everything's okay. It doesn't look like you're going to cause anything to be overloaded. You can connect. Or if you're going to connect, the cost will be much less. With network, they kind of stress test it. They do contingencies where, you know, an N-1 or maybe even an N-2, and then they determine with that whether upgrades are necessary. And when you're going into contingency land, the chances of upgrades are much higher. So that's why ERES is a much cheaper solution for someone who does not have a purchase power agreement in place. So, and from what I understand at this time, this company does not have a PPA in place with any of the companies, or at least not for the entire load.
So with NRES, you own your access to the grid. That's yours, and you get to use it. And they can't just shut you off because the grid's busy. But with ERES, it's like an interruptible rate. You're as available. You can put stuff into the grid. The NRES, like Victor was saying, they will require their upgrades done before the interconnection is allowed.
Sure. So that ERES, it's cheaper, but you're also not guaranteed to be able to use the grid when you have power available.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's kind of concerning when you think about, so that study is done for these connections, but then both of the RTOs do studies for market efficiency projects or reliability projects, and that's when these kind of things come into play, where when they do one of those studies, they model, are going to do that model with these, all of these generators on, and it's not probably one generator necessarily by itself, but the accumulation of numerous generators on ERES service could cause an economic or reliability upgrade, and they wouldn't have to pay for any of that. It would all be the load.
And that's what's caused some kind of devastating consequences to a couple companies. And for over a year already, we're trying to find a solution.
Yeah, it's very difficult to
come up with something that doesn't have a lot of pushback from others then.
But I would be concerned if we tried to tell them that they couldn't ERES connect, because it's a FERC-approved tariff that allows interconnection.
Right.
It is. I guess I would agree with Commissioner Christman. It's something to be certainly aware of. And
yeah.
And does it really apply to siting? Does it fit in with our siting criteria?
I don't know. And like I said, there was no opposition to it, but it seems like an ongoing and developing problem. So I just didn't want it to have not even been acknowledged and discussed here. That
so it's a business
risk. In the future, we might need to look at things differently.
That's not so much of a business risk for the company building the wind farm. It's a risk for utilities in the area that serve load.
Down the road.
Might be a utility quite a ways away, but now when they do the new upgrade to the system, that company ends up paying for their share of that, and if quite a bit of it's in their territory, they absorb the cost because some of these were added.
I would suggest that in the future hearings, that perhaps some of the questions be developed in advance of a hearing so that the company has the ability to look into the questions and has then the ability to answer them at the hearing.
Yeah.
Because I think, Commissioner, if you ask those questions, I would suspect it would be, well, we'll have to get a late file exhibit type of situation. But I think it potentially does play in to your review of the applications. On this case, though, it wasn't brought up. So and no one objected, as you noted.
Yep. Two transmission companies that
right.
are aware of this in this particular RTO, and
right.
they didn't complain. So
they were there.
So then, and we kind of touched on it a little bit when we were talking about SHPO, but the other groups that offered some concern, and again, I think the U.S. Fish and Wildlife is pretty much the same thing, but Game and Fish's letter, like I said, mentioned several studies, and they're using scientific information. We believe there will be adverse environmental impacts. They then say that Tradewind acknowledged the impacts associated with the project and indicated they're developing a voluntary offset package. Now, Zach, did you say that the package is done now, or... Because in my notes, the company said that it would be done by the end of March,
right.
which I've never gotten anything, but...
No, that hasn't... End of March didn't happen. And to answer your question, no, nothing has been agreed to other than the internal agreement, apparently, amongst the company in formulating the proposal to be presented to Game and Fish is where it's at right now.
Yeah, it has not been presented yet, is my understanding. And so the Game and Fish would have to see it and decide if they like it or not.
I do think, Commissioner, I do have to disagree a little bit. I do think that the company's position and the testimony at the hearing was such that they were working with Game and Fish, but they believe that the mitigation that they had stated in the application was sufficient and address it. But, I mean, that's...
The movement of before the hearing of some...
Right. I mean, the movement of some of the turbines, and as well as avoidance of grasslands, not all, but, you know, a large amount. So I do think that the company did provide some testimony that would support its position. But again, here we have a situation where we have a voluntary
yeah.
offer that's from this email from this morning, and I believe it, it's going to be done. They're going to make a voluntary offer to Game and Fish, and there is no requirement for any type of offset to be done. There's requirements for mitigation.
There's not a requirement for it to be done.
Right.
That's true. And these, most things in the world aren't just black and white. It's a
no.
these, like,
that's
we're
why
not
you guys
gonna,
have to have me here.
we're not going to have environment or energy projects where you could everyone could agree there are absolutely zero impacts. There's going to be impacts.
Yes.
So, but the question is, when we have that statement on the record and still nothing filed as far as an offset, now I got to think about your point about the changes they had made, if any of those were made between early February and the hearing, but then, you know, maybe we approve the project anyway and we say, well, despite what Game and Fish says, we think that they're, that it's not that much, but unless there's something to either mitigate it or dispute it, can we really say that it produces minimal adverse effects and that the proposed energy conversion facility is compatible with environmental use of resources and the kinds of things we typically say in our orders
right.
when what's on the record from the agency with expertise in that area is that there are adverse impacts?
I think what we need to do in this discussion, and it's a good discussion to have, I think, Commissioner, is we need to tamp down on what, specifically what. And my reading of the Game and Fish letter, which Fish and Wildlife Service seemed to just latch onto, it's kind of almost say ditto. They don't say ditto, but it That's how I read it, is more with the waterfall, right? I mean, with the prairie potholes and those types of waterfall. So we look at the endangered and threatened species list that the company has identified. I don't think that there's any dispute as to those conclusions on that. I mean, obviously the kind of the most important, at least in my view, would be the whooping cranes, and it's within the flyway, and the Fish and Wildlife and Game and Fish. To me, I read the letters, and while they're noted as a whooping crane flyway and that mitigation should be done, it doesn't seem that that's what Game and Fish is wanting. It seems that they're more concerned about other types of waterfall that are more prevalent in North Dakota and would not be killed necessarily, but may be displaced to other areas. Now, how do you mitigate that? And I think the company has in its application indicated what it plans to do. It has moved turbines. It has located its facilities in areas that would lessen and mitigate those potential impacts. I mean, if you talk about the LEX, the company has agreed to have it's either a mile or a half mile, buffer. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it is a buffer, and no one has any issues with that. So I think in terms of mitigation, the company has indicated there would be mitigation. The question, I think, now for you, Commissioner, and other commissioners, is whether or not that mitigation that's been presented is sufficient. And if you determine that it's not, then are you going to require that this voluntary offset then be done to meet the mitigation? I think then we get into a little bit difficult territory, because then we're looking at this voluntary offset, which is by very nature voluntary, and then are we then telegraphing in the future to other companies that, well, this voluntary offset is voluntary in name only, and it potentially is a slippery slope, is what I'm saying.
I agree, and I want to emphasize, I'm not suggesting that it is that it has to be there or you can't build this.
Yeah.
But I don't want our order to imply that things have been done that weren't done.
Right.
And
I see what you're saying.
If someone says that there's a negative here, then we need to either say we just don't really buy into that, it's not that big of a deal.
Right.
Or the company has addressed it or something. But I when they haven't, I don't want to act like
they have,
like it had.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think, if you compare this here in Emma's Logan, there was, a little bit more testimony just from a subjective viewpoint, my subjective viewpoint on why the voluntary offset wasn't needed. There was no testimony at either this hearing or the Emma's Logan from Game and Fish, which I think should play into it as well. But, I mean, here we do have statements from the company saying, well, we're looking into voluntary offsets. We're looking into voluntary offsets. Whereas in Emmons Logan, that was stated, but then when pinned down, the company representative said, no, we're not going to do voluntary offsets at the hearing specifically. Here we don't have that. We have the company saying we're going to do voluntary offsets. So the question, I guess, from the practical standpoint is are we going to wait until there's something in place, or are we going to just sidestep it with the knowledge that it's being done and it's being worked on? And I have no reason to doubt what the company is doing here, that they're going to follow through. But Jerry's right. I mean, Game and Fish will have to review it, and I suppose it's possible that they could say, we don't think it's adequate. And, I mean, then where does that leave us?
But isn't the more appropriate thing, though, to address it, that the Game and Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife presented their concerns, and
The company did address. I mean, I think if you look at
it. And that is what they did to address it, that it's not this voluntary offset because we don't know that there is a voluntary offset. They haven't filed anything. And so just to be clear that,
yeah,
you know, I'm kind of ready to go on this thing, but I don't want it to seem like the voluntary offset, which isn't done, is a factor in it. To approve it, to me, it's about the things that they did do, pushing that off the grasslands, pushing it to the edge of the grasslands, where it was left on. I'd feel better about it if they eliminated those ones on the Department of Trust lands, but I'd feel even, and that's another, I have one more thing to bring up, but I'll hold that one.
Go ahead, Jerry.
I was going to say that I don't think that we would even put anything about plan in the order, except unless you want to say that they're working with Game and Fish on an offset, voluntary offset plan, but I wouldn't say anything more than that.
Yeah, when nothing's been filed, I just don't think we can. I really would dislike that.
And, you know, I wonder, you need to find minimal adverse effects. If you don't, I don't know that you can have them pay some money for it. I mean, the whole concept of the offset stuff seems to be lacking a little bit.
Well, presumably, I mean, one would hope that the offsets are used to create other habitat, not that it's just a fine.
And in some respects, I mean, look, I mean, we're kind of, I don't mean to go down any further down the rabbit hole than that's not to suggest that we're down a rabbit hole, Commissioner, but, you know, I mean, in some respects, you know, what the commission decides on these cases where voluntary offsets are in will drive the practical policy of future siting cases. And I think, you know, in Foxtail, and I wasn't involved in Foxtail, but I'm aware, you know, there was a voluntary offset done. And then in Emmons Logan, the same company as in Foxtail, said, no, we're not doing this because we've met it. And they've made their point. I mean, here we have, you know, it's a different case. Circumstances are different. We do have a company that's saying, okay, we're looking at a voluntary offset. We're working with Game and Fish, but we don't have it completed. But we still believe that we've mitigated, and we still believe that there are minimal, you know, adverse impacts on environment. But we're still gonna go the extra step here. It's kind of how I view it in some respects on this case.
And this one is just sort of somewhere in the middle of the others, you know. In Foxtail, what to me was the big thing in Foxtail, we not only had the company saying they were going to do a voluntary package. At the time, as I recall, it wasn't even done yet, like this. But we had Game and Fish, and I believe U.S. Fish and Wildlife probably also, saying, we've made good progress. We're pulling back our objection to this project.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
That, to me, made it significantly different. The objection had been released. It's not been released here.
But is there an objection? That's the problem. I don't see an objection.
And, you know, like we got in the Burke one, we got is to, we object. I don't think we got that in this one.
No.
I'm still struggling to find their earlier letters, but in the final letter, February 7th, from Game and Fish, they say, in early consultations, we applauded Tradewind Energy as the majority of the project was within a relatively low sensitive area with respect to native habitats. However, we emphasize the importance of careful placement of or micro-siting of turbines, roads, and other associated infrastructure and asset in the impacts to native prairie, blah, 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 wetlands, woodlands be avoided to the extent possible. And then they go into this habitat loss formula and suggesting that Tradewind acknowledged the impacts associated with this project and indicated they were developing a voluntary offset package to address the impacts. The department has been encouraged by Tradewind's commitments
and hopeful that a successful project can be achieved through our continued collaboration. However, until we are presented with specific details, it's difficult for the department to provide a full assessment of the project. So they're saying they can't fully assess it, I guess, but they aren't saying they object.
Yeah, but I think the defining sentence was in between the areas that you read, the very last sentence on the first page. Using this scientific information, we believe there will be adverse environmental impacts that should be offset.
But then they water it down a bit at the end by saying, well, we can't address it. And I think that they could have addressed it. They could have said, well, until we have the voluntary offsets, then we object to the project. They didn't do that. So, I mean, and the other thing, too, we could go round and round for a while on this because, I mean, we're trying to read what someone else wrote and subjectively apply it to this case. I do think, you know, at this point, you know, I agree with Jerry. I think that there doesn't need to be mention of this in the order. I think that, and this is a decision for the three of you, of course, is you know, does the record support, you know, finding a minimal adverse impact? And I think that argument can be made for that determination, which isn't to suggest that an argument could be made against. It's what you as commissioners are comfortable with on the record. And I would encourage you to maybe review some of the transcript as to some of the environmental testimony that was offered by the company if you are struggling on this particular area, as well as look at the application as well.
Yeah. And remember, they moved a lot of turbines out of grasslands.
Well, I'd like to see that, too. I'm not seeing that right here on this one.
Was that before February 7th, or was that something they did those last couple weeks?
I think
I was trying to remember that.
Yeah.
Usually Game and Fish references that in their letter.
And I'll have to review it, too. I get, like,
We'll get that information to you guys when the turbines were moved and the response of Game and Fish to the extent there was one.
So let me just throw in one more thing and then I'll be quiet. Maybe.
That's okay.
The last thing that here's maybe what I find most disappointing, because I don't think that the Game and Fish made, or U.S. Fish and Wildlife, made a real good case for those impacts. They said, we think that there are adverse impacts. They didn't, I think, also make a real compelling case. You know, we've cited I don't know how many wind farms over the years, and most, if not all, have been willing to, when they have their final site map done. And again, I always emphasize this. I'm not saying don't pay those people, but constrain their footprint to the areas necessary and not go way beyond it. And had we not, we would have tens of thousands more acres in North Dakota in wind farm siting areas. And, you know, that can have consequences for other infrastructure development that we may need someday. 44,000 acres in this, and you see parcels in there that are not very close to wind turbines, and I'm just disappointed that and I asked that day, and pretty much said they have no intention to it, and I just find that disturbing, because if they get away with it, I suppose others will continue to do the same thing. We'll just put more in the footprint than necessary, so someday when we want to add on, or if there's a potential to add on, no one else can, because we've got the lease and we've got the site. And if we, like I say, I don't recall that we've let them go with having so much unnecessary acreage in the past, and I find it frustrating to think of doing that in this case.
I don't think that this would necessarily make you feel any better, Commissioner, but the same type of concern or issue is also applicable to an oil and gas lease, probably applicable to a coal lease. I mean, if you are a landowner or a mineral owner and you lease your land, they put a well on your property, it's held, and nobody else is coming on. Only that company that has the lease. So it doesn't make you feel any better, I know, but there are instances also that apply not just wind on wind turbine easements.
I don't know if it's the reality per se, but that caught my eye immediately. Foxtel was the first wind hearing I've been through, so I am, temper my remarks as not being a long-term expert on the subject, but I started actually doing comparisons on acreage, and I started asking the questions at the hearings. Why do you need 600 acres per turbine?
Yeah.
When I was comparing it to, and I've asked that question because it hit me right away that these footprints were massive in nature, and then you start getting into a situation where a turbine that meets a setback requirement from a property line and just across on that new non-participating parcel of land, if there are grasslands there, but they're not in the project footprint, they're not, it's not a problem. So if it's within the footprint and it's twice as big a footprint, then there are more acres within the footprint. So if the footprint even goes 10 miles beyond the last turbine, now it's just terribly inconsistent. And how, it's just looking within that immediate project footprint, even though, and I thought one of the landowners described it, in terms of, we like the bigger footprint because then we get, that's how we want to, and we're willing to enter into that lease with the company and be compensated, which I thought was a point that was something that I had to consider. But
well, I'm kind of frustrated just with this game and fish issue, just because normally, in the past, they've been more specific about the impacts that they're seeing and quantifying to the native habitats.
Sure have, yeah.
And I don't see that here. I also don't see it in the companies, although there's no Dakota Skipper habitat listed in this, and that is native prairie, typically. Yeah. So the fact that there's no Dakota Skipper habitat identified in this, there's suitable, but then there's not the designated habitat. Right. So that does suggest that maybe the prime native prairie that game fish has been most concerned about doesn't exist a lot in this footprint. But see anything in here quantifying the impacts to the native prairie. There's a lot on the birds. And the LECs and there's specific mitigation that can be cited to those, and I think they're addressed.
It doesn't seem that Game and Fish is as concerned about the native prairie in this one as they are with waterfowl. That's but again, you're right. It's not as detailed as some of the other letters we've seen.
Because the original, it is mostly broken ground in this one, and so I think that was a big difference. Good. And why I didn't find Game and Fish concerns real overwhelming.
Okay. Well, to the extent that we can quantify the mitigation that they've done on the, and maybe their order does that, I haven't read their draft order, quantify the mitigation and how it addresses the game and fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife issues, I think that's good. A bigger issue to me before approving this, even in attempting to make a decision on this or approving this order, is that they have all the easements in place.
Yeah, right.
There's no circumstances would I consider taking action until I know that the landowners have voluntarily completed their negotiations. So,
there is one outstanding landowner, which is the state of North Dakota.
Well, there's others.
Which has indicated
they
will not enter into an easement agreement with the company until the PSC has actually approved the permit, which makes it impossible to have all the easements.
I'm going to put them in a separate category.
Oh.
I'm talking about private landowners.
Well, we know Molly is on the phone, and we know that she'll report to the company.
Yeah, so as soon as we get that, then I think that's a key piece, and then we can. But meanwhile, we should be revising the company's order, making it our order, and addressing the things that we've talked about today.
This is Molly. Could I just offer one thought on your last comment, Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Sure.
We did include in the order a condition that the site would only be designated as to those parcels that aren't leased if they executed a lease, because we understood that to be a concern, so we were trying to address that in advance.
I'll look at that. My issue is I don't – so you approving it without that parcel, that would be what we'd be doing?
Subject to.
I don't like making our orders contingent on private people making their decisions. Not in these.
So there would be an alternate site, I would expect, if they didn't get those sites that they would use?
The thing I want to avoid, and I'm not saying this company would do that, but just as a rule of thumb, on projects where it is a voluntary, there is no eminent domain tool, I don't want us getting out ahead and providing some sort of leverage that the company could, if they wanted to, say, we've already got our permits. You got no choice here. And that's just not a situation I want to start creating. So I will stay firm to my position on this, that until the easements are secured and we know that, I won't be taking any action on a wind farm. So if you want to take that piece out and not do that, that's, you know, not part of the project anymore. That would be one option.
Just so you know, one of our concerns is the opposite, that we can't use eminent domain, and therefore the company is actually trapped. They can't get an order until they issue a permit or enter into an easement, and that easement, the power with the easement, is in the landowner's hands because it's voluntary. So we're seeing it the opposite way, actually.
No, and not really, because what I'm saying is, yes, you guys know you can't use eminent domain, but landowners have been threatened by companies in the past or cajoled or intimidated in ways suggesting the PSC has already approved this. And so then they get to thinking they have no choice and they sign. So that's the situation. I'm not saying your company has or would do that. I'm just saying that's the situation I want to avoid. So, I mean, that landowner needs to make its decision, or you guys can take them out of the project. I guess that would be the other option, is just don't go with your alternate location and give up on them. Do you have any other issues, Randy?
Nope.
All right. Have we covered everything, Zach? Jerry?
I think so.
I think we're good.
Yeah.
All right.
I will say this. I think the company, I would presume, wants to hurry along. I think the decisions that are, I mean, they've had all this time, like as far as any kind of a impact plan, a mitigation plan, I mean, or reducing their acreage or getting these last easements signed. At some point, these things have to come to an end, and I think we need to write our order and make a decision either up or down based on the information we have and not necessarily put it off forever either.
Okay. Well, let's call this one good and see how we get in with the permit or the order, working on the order and tying up these loose ends.
Yeah, so when I get an order ready to present, I'll email it around.
Okay, very good. Okay, thank you, everybody.